Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. T. Colin Campbell. For more than 40 years now, Dr. Campbell has been at the forefront of nutrition research. He served as project director of the China Project, which is considered the most comprehensive study of health and nutrition ever conducted. Dr. Campbell is the Jacob Gold Sherman Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University, and he's led more than 70 grant years of peer-reviewed research and has authored more than 300 research papers. He's the best-selling co-author of the China Study, Startling Implications for Diet, Weight Loss, and Long-Term Health, and of WHOLE, Rethinking the Science of Nutrition. He's also co-author of the recently released book, The Low-Carb Fraud. Dr. Campbell is well known for his starring role in the hit film Forks Over Knives and for being part of the team that inspired President Bill Clinton to choose a plant-strong diet. So now, Dr. Campbell, my dad and I are so grateful for your decades of courageous and dedicated and studious work, and we're so happy to have this time with you today. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Colin, for being with us and taking time out of your schedule. And I want to start right away with one of the most widely held beliefs today, which is that animal protein is superior to plant protein. I know your research points in a very different direction. Can you tell us how you have come to the conclusion that our faith in the supremacy of animal protein is not just misguided, but dangerous?
Sure. Well, as many may know, I was raised on a dairy farm where protein is valued as far as content milk is concerned. And then when I went away to graduate school and started my research career, again, it was focused on the idea of making sure we could produce enough protein, namely in the form of animal-based foods. So the first 5, 6, or 7 years of my career was that purpose. But then I got involved in the Philippines in a study there where we were attempting to help develop a program for feeding malnourished children, a nationwide program. And that went on for about 10 years, and I just happened to learn something rather different than what I thought I knew in the beginning. And that was, to put it briefly, the children who were from the few families who seemed to have the most protein, those children seemed to be more vulnerable to a certain kind of cancer, which is kind of odd. And then came a report from India, laboratory animal study showing something similar. And so that then the rest of my career was begun. The one thing led to another, and that proceeded over the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years, mostly funded from the National Institutes of Health. It was one project we had, the main project, went on for 27 years. It was repeatedly funded, which is a very competitive process, and we won funding something like 8 straight times.
What were you finding out about protein?
I eventually learned that it wasn't just protein causing cancer. It was really protein fed in excess, you know, that seemed to be the problem. First, and secondly, it was protein from animal sources that seemed to have the problem. Protein from plant sources didn't. Those were quite detailed biochemical kinds of studies, I admit, on the one hand. But on the other hand, they had the potential for having major implications as far as human health is concerned, not just on the question concerning protein, but also on the question concerning just nutrition in general and how it would work. We finally had an opportunity to look at the population in China, a big cohort there, a cross-sectional study. And at that particular point in time, we were involved with the University of Oxford as well as Cornell and the Chinese academies. And that effort was intended primarily not to look specifically at protein and cancer or any other disease. It was looking at the much broader effects of all kinds of nutrition, all kinds of disease outcomes. And I wanted to see if what we saw in that population, that very unique population, was in any way in agreement with what we had been finding in the laboratory. And it was. So it was really quite consistent. In the early 1990s, I was quite comfortable with where I had arrived intellectually with our data. and my early impressions of the importance of protein had vaporized. And then I became quite interested in the whole question concerning protein. Why do we so misunderstand protein?
We've come to have a very high regard for protein. Where does that come from?
It goes back to the middle 1800s when protein was first discovered. Throughout this entire period now, going on 175 years or so, the public has come to revere this nutrient somehow. They tend to think of protein as synonymous with meat. Still, a lot of people think that these days. But we've known for a long time, and I would hope a growing number of people would know it now, that plants have protein, they have good protein, and quite frankly, when we start looking at the sort of relationship between intake and function and output, plants have really the ideal level of protein. Not that they just have enough, they actually have the ideal level of protein. And when we're consuming protein at that level, and just getting rid of this mythology of assuming we have to have more, when we do consume protein at that level, then all the other nutrients begin to fall in place at the right levels. So I look at it in sort of a theoretical construct in a way. If we assume that everybody's eating a plant-based diet with a proper level of protein, then what really we have done as a society, many other societies too, we start gradually introducing animal-based foods because of its protein content, because we worship it in a sense. As we start doing that process, then we begin to displace these good plant products, the antioxidants and complex carbohydrates and the good protein it has and so forth and so on. And so what we end up with now is sort of a transition, and that's where we are now as a society, a transition where the animal protein-based foods, obviously animal foods, have so displaced the plant-based foods that we're getting a double whammy. First, we're suffering from the consequences of consuming animal-based foods and the nutrients that they have, but we also at the same time are suffering from the lack of the really good nutrients placed in plant-based foods. That's the combination that I think, from everything I can see, it just begins to really change the paradigm. Turns out that that's the combination, and I believe it is really the combination. It's not about a single nutrient. It's not even protein. It's not about any particular nutrient in particular or any particular disease. It turns out when we start looking at it that way, in a more wholesome kind of way, and whole foods and so forth, that's why we see these spectacular results from people who choose to eat plant-based foods.
I'm thinking of one person in particular right now, because the common thinking is that we need animal protein, in particular for strength. And I'm thinking of Tony Gonzalez. He's a football player. I know you're friends with him. He's an NFL player. He's had one of the most remarkable careers of anyone in sports history, really. He's a 14-time Pro Bowl selection. He holds NFL records for touchdown receptions and total reception yards by a tight end. His durability is phenomenal. He's missed two games in his 17-year career playing in the NFL. Now, you know him, and he has stated publicly, quote, this is Tony Gonzalez, "After reading the China study and drastically changing my diet toward the more whole food, plant-based diet recommended by Dr. Campbell, my career numbers shot up when they were supposed to be declining." End quote from Tony Gonzalez. Colin, what's been your experience with Tony and his diet?
Well, he was on a plane. This was written up originally in the Wall Street Journal. He was on a plane headed into his 11th season to the training program before they started the season, at the beginning of his 11th year. And until then, he had an outstanding record, of course, and he'd been the number one guy and a tight end in that position and touchdowns and yards gained and all that sort of stuff. When he's on this plane, a guy next to him was not eating the steak and lobster, whatever it was, that they eat in first class. And Tony turned to him and said, "Why are you not doing that?" So he pulled up the book, said it was a China study. So he went and read that. And then he decided to do it at the beginning of that training session. At that point in time, his face was on the billboards all around Kansas, where he was at the time, you know, with the white mustaches. He had really bought into the good old American diet, I guess you could say. So he started this thing, and then he all of a sudden just had the results himself. And his performance is improving and so forth and so on. He called me up and asked me, what's all this about? We had a conversation. I won't go into the details here, but he was really impressed. And then I introduced him to a friend of mine who now owns something like 15 gyms around the world, a weightlifter who himself is 100% plant-based. And he's been working with professional athletes, actually. So I got him together with this fellow. His name is John Hines, during his training session. So John and I and Tony then started forming a little group talking about things, and one thing leading to another. And so Tony stuck with it through the years. He's not perfect. I have to say that. It's a really interesting sort of phenomenon. He couldn't quite ever bring himself to be convinced that it had to be 100% because he's, after all, playing in the game. He wants every ounce of effort that he can muster for the game. And so he's used some protein supplement, but it was a plant protein supplement. And he also tended to have fish, I think, once a week, last time I checked. So he's not a 100% guy, but in any case, he's maintained this position until the 17th year. And all during that time, he's broken records right and left for length of service, if you call it that. Now I'm running into other professional athletes, too, who are doing similar things. And it's all kind of exciting. It's an idea not well received amongst their colleagues initially, but the idea is spreading. And Tony turned out to be a great friend and a real champion in many ways. He's a class act citizen as far as what he wants to do with his life. So that was a lot of fun.
That's a beautiful story, and it illustrates something for all of us. There's a question that's out there. You are widely recognized now as one of the foremost advocates of a whole foods plant-based diet. Yet there are some who allege that a vegan diet or even a plant-strong vegan-ish diet conflicts with human nature, with our nature as human beings. How do you respond to this allegation?
I don't know. It's a different one, John. I know a lot of people sort of have come to believe that almost in their guts, in a sense. I mean, it's very heartfelt. They believe that kind of thing. I think the person I probably most often quote in that regard is a guy named James Mason, who wrote The Nature of Things, I believe, some years ago, a lawyer from Missouri. Got involved with Peter Singer, actually, and published a book with him, too. And his argument was that somehow, you know, they got this idea that when we were gradually coming into the agricultural period many, many years ago, of course, people wanted to eat meat because they saw animals being fast. They wanted to be fast. They were strong. We wanted to be strong, so forth and so on. I mean, that's speculation, but I guess that's where it comes from. And it stays with it. I think in the more recent years, though, there's a really strong industry behind this, as we all know, or industries plural, you know, behind this idea of promoting animal protein-based foods, because they have this very important nutrient called protein. So they are sponsoring the mythology, quite frankly, just going forward. And I'm not sure that until now we've had the kind of evidence we have now that we can speak to that myth. There has been some really interesting data going back on protein and heart disease, for example. I just had an opportunity to look at that more carefully, that in the very beginning, the relationship of diet with heart disease, there was very good data and convincing data that it was animal protein that was causing an increase in blood cholesterol and atherogenesis, more so than the saturated fat or total fat. It turns out that, in my experience at least, my colleagues, they just don't want to hear anything bad about animal protein. It's almost like it's so sacrosanct. We can't speak of it in those terms. But we can talk about fat. Been doing that since the 50s and 60s and 70s. We can talk about fat because we can skim it off of milk. We can use lean cuts of meat and so forth and so on, as if that's the good answer. You know, that's not really true. Do that, then the proportion of total calories come in the form of protein actually goes up. So then as a result of that, we don't see any effect by decreasing fat intake. We don't see any effect on breast cancer risk, for example, as the Nurses' Health study showed. I think this is going to come back into the forefront, that it's really animal protein, not just itself, but also this really interesting effect that when we consume that, we displace the other good things. That idea is going to come again. I really believe that strongly. So the detractors who somehow can't quite fathom that idea, I don't know. It's whatever impression people have. I don't know exactly what that's due to, why they feel so strongly for that idea.
The word protein derives from a Greek word that literally means of primary importance.
Mm-hmm.
And the assumption that the more protein we consume, the better, is so deeply entrenched. I see that the low-carb diets, Atkins, The Zone, South Beach, Paleo Diet, and others, play off of that thinking, yet you've repeatedly said that the ability of these low-carb diets to bring about quick weight loss is far outweighed by the serious health problems that they cause. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, we see that, as you know, in the low-carb diets, the Atkins diet, the South Beach diet, you name it, protein power, paleo, those kind of diets. We see that quick weight loss, especially among people who are really quite a bit overweight, and John McDougall, I think, is one who first expressed this best, and that is calorie consumption is cut in the beginning. And so people are going to lose weight just to start with on that front. And there's some other sort of biological, biochemical explanations, and they may be somewhat reasonable. The ketotic state that people experience, that cuts down appetite, and they sort of lose appetite that way. So we're going to see some changes that look favorable to a lot of people. We also see sometimes, and pretty consistent, that we see some decrease in cholesterol. You know, as people cut calories and lose weight, some cholesterols, serum cholesterol levels tend to go down a bit. That all looks quite impressive to a lot of people who are looking for weight loss. I can understand that. But that doesn't last. It doesn't last for a couple of reasons, and we now have pretty good evidence for that. People don't want to stay there because that ketotic state leads to a lot of other outcomes that aren't so good, adverse effects that begin to appear fairly quickly. The data that I see, most of them have given it up by 6 months for sure. Few individuals, hardy souls maybe, will go on for a year or two. They tend to be younger people. When we're young, we can almost eat anything and just survive. But that's sort of the early history of that. But then if we look at the population data where people have spent many years on their respective diets, there it's very clear that people who are consuming these high-protein diets and high-fat diets have the higher rates of cancers and heart disease by far. That is without dispute. So the long-range effects of these kinds of diets, if in fact people really want to survive on them, the long range, it's just simply not there. And for people to say otherwise, they really don't know what they're talking about.
We hear the phrase low-carb and even the word carb, obviously shortening of the actual word carbohydrates. And it's almost developed a stigma. Carbs are bad, carbohydrates are bad. And I think there's a kernel of truth in that the vast majority of carbohydrates in the standard American diet come from white flour and added sugars, be it high fructose corn syrup or straight sugar or many of the other sweeteners that are used in processed foods in very, very high quantities. So I'm thinking that the bad reputation that carbohydrate foods have gotten really is undeserved, except for the type of carbohydrates, the highly refined, highly processed, that unfortunately make up the majority of the carbohydrate intake in the American diet.
Yeah, well put. I'm led to believe on the basis of those kinds of information that the word carb was initially invented as a marketing tool. I mean, to have a nice short four-letter word like that, it sort of brings the public into this discussion a bit. It's kind of a marketing word. And when that was first introduced, mostly by Dr. Atkins and his followers, at that particular time, it was being used almost indiscriminately. Low-carb diet, low-carb this, low-carb that. Well, it turns out, as we both know, and they knew too, that carbohydrates are entirely from plants. So in many ways, it was sort of a negation, if you will, of the interest that we were all getting in plants at that time. And this was the counterpunch. They said, wait a minute, we're consuming these high-carb diets. I think it was a frontal attack on those of us who had an interest in exploring the health value of plant-based foods. And so it went for a while, and they got a little more careful, as we went along, no, we're talking about refined carbohydrates, white flours, and sugars. But they didn't make that very obvious. I mean, we can all agree that refined carbohydrates are problematic in many regards. So I think that's what was going on there. I'm really rather convinced of that, especially having been in the policy committee and hearing these kinds of discussions going on.
Speaking of food marketing, our supermarket shelves today are filled with processed foods that claim to be healthy because they are nutritionally enhanced. We have breakfast cereals with added vitamins. We have white bread with added fiber. There's even soft drinks with added vitamins, like Diet Coke Plus, which claims that it's healthy because it contains a few B vitamins. And now we're seeing probiotic ice cream. We're seeing snack bars with added fiber, omega-3 fortified baby foods, low glycemic index meal replacements. I mean, it just goes on and on. It seems to me, and I want to know what you think, that food companies are creating a nutritional facade around processed food products.
Yeah, that's a very mild and polite statement. I mean, I'm quite frankly, I'm really getting sick of their antics. I've seen so much of it, and I'm sure you have, and I'm getting bolder just to say it like it is, the way I feel it is. I'm, you know, comfortable enough with the free market system. That's what we have. But it's become so intense and so capitalistic intense that the drive for profit actually overwhelms most decision-making processes by people in this particular field, it seems to me. They're more interested in making profit than making wealth instead of health. And I do get upset about this, because somehow the discussions involving health are left in the wake, and new ideas keep surfacing all the time based on some detail to try to justify their crazy products. And supplementation is one of them.
And people will buy them. I mean, there's a product called Red Bull. On the front label, it says in big letters, that is an energy drink with taurine that vitalizes body and mind. It sounds great. But if you look on the back, you find in very small letters that the first two ingredients in Red Bull are sucrose and glucose. And, of course, it's full of added caffeine. There's another. Kellogg's makes a Fruit Loops marshmallow cereal. Now, nobody would, just hearing that, think that could possibly be a healthy food. But on the box, in very large letters, it says, good source of vitamin D, which, of course, implies that it's healthy for kids to eat, even though it's almost half sugar. There's a box of Cocoa Krispies cereal right next to it in my supermarket, and you see big letters on the front telling you that this Cocoa Krispies cereal is a good source of 5 vitamins, including folate, and now helps support your child's immunity. I'm sure our listeners can think of lots of other examples of this. Cocoa Krispies claims to support your child's immunity. How do we help ourselves and our children to develop immunity to such ridiculous claims?
Well, I think my best answer is probably telling the experiences of my wife of 52 years, almost 52 years, and the raising of our children, especially now our grandchildren, since we've been around now long enough for them to start out life the right way. And she has really gotten very enthused about all the stuff that I've been doing for the last 20, 30, 40 years, and became convinced and is taking it very seriously. And so, like many women especially, when the little children are coming off the breast, and they should be breastfeeding, we start them off right early, and she was successful, even working with her grandchildren, very effective in getting them to understand so early. So when they went to school, at least the ones she was with most directly, they were proud of the fact that they were not eating meat or drinking milk. And this so-called peer pressure that we've all heard about when kids go to school, they're going to get it from their peers. My gosh, that didn't happen to our grandchildren. They're now in their 20s, actually, in college. But they went to school and maybe had their school lunches, and they didn't have the usual things everybody else did. And, yeah, some of the other kids said, what are you eating? This kind of thing. Well, they were very proud of what they're eating. And really came back at them and said, look what I got today. This is really good. Now, I only give that as an answer because everybody has their own ways of doing this, I'm sure, but I think, especially mothers with their very young children, and get them started early to think in a certain way what's good and what's not good. Working with young children, I'm really convinced, is quite important.
The habits we form tend to stay with us, and the earlier they are formed, the more deeply entrenched they are. That's why the food companies spend so much money and expertise and creativity and effort to market their products to children. Some of the products that they market most heavily, in fact, almost generally speaking, the products that are most heavily marketed to kids are the least healthy. They're the most full of added isolated sugars and fats and chemicals that the food processing industry adds to these foods to make them more appealing to kids. I know that each and every day the food industry in the United States adds more than 1,000 calories of isolated sugars and fats per person per day to the food they market and sell in this country. That is more than 40% of the total calories available to U.S. consumers. Is it possible, Colin, that one of the reasons that people sometimes don't do well when they shift toward a vegan or near-vegan diet, a plant-strong diet, is that they're still eating processed foods that are full of isolated sugars and fats, but claim to be healthy because they have added vitamins?
I think so. I think that's a good point, John. I know that there are some people who claim to be vegans, and I take the word for it, that they're not eating animal products for starters, but really in their effort to just avoid animal products, they're not thinking too deeply about this question. So they end up using a lot of refined carbohydrates for starters, the wrong kind of fat, sometimes probably too high in fat, and then throw in some vitamins. That's supposed to make them good. That's a combination. That's a recipe for lack of progress or disaster sometimes. You know, it's again a marketing ploy, and we unfortunately succumb to that. Especially people who aren't in a position to be able to look very carefully at the information. It just starts from a long diet. And you know, of course, as well as I do, that the whole taste for fat and refined carbohydrates, that's really become a physiological addiction. And we start early enough in life, any kind of addiction is pretty hard to break. They get used to this high fat, high sweet, even high salt kinds of products. And even though they may be avoiding animal foods, they're not going to be getting the response that we talk about, not this whole food, plant-based idea.
I want to thank you, Colin, for your years of dedicated work. You're a voice of sanity in a fairly insane food world today. The marketing is ubiquitous for the least healthy foods. We've taken on beliefs about protein and animal foods that really don't serve us, and those beliefs often lead us to actions that cause us great distress and disease and shortened lives. And your voice, your work, is a beacon of light in these times.
Well, let me, if I may, go one up on you, John. You know, you did some really pioneering stuff with your books and the food revolution and all of that. And I actually came along after that to lawyers and said, at least as far as my publisher was concerned, and I just found that resource extraordinarily valuable, the work that you were doing, the expressions you had for yourself. And then, of course, you know, and very kindly offered to write a foreword for my book, The China Study. And that thing has really done well, and John Robbins' name is up close up front to it, and I really appreciate that. So, can't leave you out of the equation. You are a fine
writer. Thank you. It is an honor to be your friend, to call myself something like a colleague of yours, and just to see your work influencing our society brings me great joy.
We really are all in this together, and it is an honor and a pleasure, Dr. Colin Campbell, to be working with you. We've been talking with Dr. T. Colin Campbell, the Jacob Gold Sherman Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University, and the co-author of multiple bestsellers, including the just-named China Study. And Dr. Campbell, we are so grateful for your decades of impeccable research and for sharing your insights so generously in your books, in your programs, and, of course, today in the Food Revolution Summit.
Well, I also, Ocean, I've heard you speak too, and I'm just delighted that you're carrying the torch, you know, that your dad really started, and so I'm looking forward to hearing a lot more good things from you guys.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 23 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. If you like, you can also get CDs, members-only courses, and a lot more. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thanks so much for joining us in the Food Revolution. Want to share how you're part of the Food Revolution, or to share your responses to all that's been said in the summit so far, or post questions, or engage with fellow summit participants, you can check out the comments section at the bottom of our broadcasts page. As always, you want to make sure to refresh the page so you can see the latest. Also remember, you can engage on our Facebook page and like it as well at facebook.com/foodrevolutionsummit. This right now concludes day 5 of the Food Revolution Summit. I hope you'll come back and join us tomorrow for Celebrities Who Really Care, How Your Food Choices Shape the Future of Life. We'll be hearing from Alicia Silverstone on The Kind Life, the food babe Vani Hari on How You Can Change Food Systems, and movie and TV star Woody Harrelson speaking right from the heart. So please come on back and join us tomorrow. We wish you health, we wish you happiness, we wish you joy, and we wish you lots of good food.
Mm-hmm.